it was joyful. And it was, design was really just a part of our daily life. So it was in the objects. It was literally in the silverware and in the candelabra and in the furniture and the textiles. Everything was chosen because it had been designed with thought and heart. There was definitely a sense of emotion that was embedded in a lot of the things that my parents chose.
Welcome to Buildings 2.0, where we dive deep into the technology, trends, and visionaries reshaping the very structures we work in. Here is your host, Jose Cruz Jr., CEO of Integrated Projects.
Hey, everyone, and thanks for listening to another episode of Buildings 2.0. Today, I'm speaking with Robin Elmsley Osler, Principal Creative Director at Arcadis. Robin, thanks for chatting with me today.
You're welcome. It's great to be here.
I want to dive in. I mean, just to hear your story, before you're an architect, before you taught, before you're a student, what's your background? We have time. So
yeah, okay. Well, I come from an architect's family. I grew up in the Midwest. My grandfather was the founding dean of the School of Architecture at the University of Michigan. He actually brought Eliel Saarinen to Michigan to teach, which is how Cranbrook happened. So we're very embedded within the Cranbrook world. My great uncle was George Elmsley, who Frank Lloyd Wright brought over from, I think it was Burnham's office, to go to Louis Sullivan's office. And Elmsley was there. He was the principal designer at Sullivan's office for 15 years. When Frank Lloyd Wright left, he wanted him to come with him. And my great uncle said, no. You know, he felt very loyal to Sullivan. And also there were issues, you know, he was actually quite a bit of autonomy in that position. My father was an architect of note in the Midwest. And my uncle, actually, he's the only one that wasn't the blood. He was the founding head of the School of Architecture at the University of Utah. So
you were destined to pursue.
Well, yeah. You know, it's interesting. And I tell the story that when I was growing up, there were no female role models. So I actually didn't think that I could do what all these in my family were doing. And I grew up in an incredible environment. Because my father was an architect, my mother came from this family. Everything around us was about design, right? But it was an environment, it wasn't pretentious and it wasn't serious. You know, it was joyful. And it was, design was really just a part of our daily life. So it was in the objects. It was literally in the silverware and in the candelabra and in the furniture and the textiles. Everything was chosen because it had been designed with thought and heart. There was definitely a sense of emotion that was embedded in a lot of the things that my parents chose. And what's also interesting is my mother subscribed to the Vogues and Bazaars that were really fabulous. Then they were big format. And the editors at that time were artists and graphic designers, and a lot of them from Russia. And so there was this sensibility of just like magic in those magazines, right? Like graphically, fashion, everything. I have always been very tall and skinny. Fortunately, I'm still, I think, a little skinny. I haven't started to shrink yet, but I ended up, because I didn't think I could do what all these men in my family did, I ended up, my first job, I mean, I did a bunch of other little jobs, you know, working in restaurants and stuff like that, but I got a job as Oscar De La Renta's house mom. And so that was in New York City. I was basically the body where the clothes were made on, right? And so what I got out of that was an understanding of how a garment goes from sketch to the muslin, to the sample, to the show, to the photography, to showing it to buyers, to how it gets transformed into a garment for a person with a regular shaped body, right? How it gets publicized. I mean, it was a fascinating lesson. And from there, because I didn't want to do that forever, I went to Europe. I just sort of picked up and left and went to Europe, and with just a little money in my pocket. I didn't have any guarantee of what was going to happen. Although Oscar did sort of pave the way a little bit. So I went right around showtime in the fall to Paris, and I got a bunch of bookings. And then they sent me out on a print booking. My first print booking was with a photographer named Helmut Newton, and I got that job.
Wow.
And I thought, I'm working with one of the best photographers in the world. Maybe I should stick around. So I got an apartment and I ended up living in Paris 3.5 years, in Italy for 5. I had a really interesting career. I learned a lot. I speak French and Italian through that experience. And one of the things that I realized by living there is the things I was noticing, right? I would go to these cities I'd never been before. I was often working alone and I was doing print because of the way I looked. And so I would just get out and explore, you know, these cities. And I started to recognize that I was really identifying with the things that I was seeing, that I was curious. And so it was sort of lighting that little fire inside of me, I think, that had been planted since birth, but I had never really felt comfortable enough or confident enough to pursue it. And so after living in Europe for 8 years, I decided I wanted to test if I wanted to pursue this design path. And so I came back. I just did a summer program at Columbia. They do that summer discovery thing. I think those things are great, which is deeply embedding you in the experience of being in architecture school. I loved it. Absolutely loved it. So I thought, okay, let's follow this path. I ended up at the University of Virginia. I went in as a sophomore. And because I'd had all this other experience. And from there, I took a year off between undergraduate and graduate. And I lived on a 400-acre farm in a 17th century log cabin. And sometimes when it was really hot, I would sleep outside. I would literally take all of my blankets outside. I'd wake up with like donkeys and horses and things in my face. It was
terrific. Visually, I'm tracking from Paris, Italy, New York to now. Seems like the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, it was quite a journey. And I ended up going to Yale graduate school. You know, my brother, I'm more on the family. I mean, my brother is an architect and a landscape architect and had a Rome Prize in landscape architecture and worked at Cranbrook and did a lot of work there. And so he had gone to Harvard. And so I had been to Harvard a number of times. I applied, I got in, but Yale was the right place for me. Felt more intimate. I liked the smaller school experience. And from there, I mean, I graduated in a recession, so there were no jobs. I did get a job when I was in school. I worked at Caesar Palace, so I got that experience of being in a much larger office. You know, my father had a relatively small office, but it was something that, you know, he did big projects, but they were, you know, we would probably call it a boutique office. So that's what I knew. I ended up getting a job with a very small firm. And of course, because of the recession, their fees dried up. And I remember standing in line, in the unemployment line. And I said, I have a graduate degree from Yale. And I am standing in the unemployment line. It was actually, I tell, you know, younger people this, because I think it's an experience that I value greatly now, because I think it gives you a sense of humility. You know, it's like, well, you know, you're not that special from everybody else, right? I mean, you can experience these challenges as well. Yeah, I ended up getting a job in New York City. I was commuting from New Haven, which is a considerable commute.
From New Haven to the city? Yes. Oh, goodness. Yes.
Yeah, because my husband was still in school there. He was in graduate school at the Divinity School there. He's a philosopher. Wow. Remember? So ended up getting a job with the firm Lee Skolnick. At a certain point, because I'd been working for a couple of guys who were Yale grads who had worked at Charlie Guathmey's office. And, you know, the hours were insane. And I just couldn't take it with the commuting and everything. Ended up moving into the city and had a partnership for 3 years, which didn't really work out. But it gave me sort of, that happened after I, for this other office, I had the opportunity to go out on my own. And I think because my father had his own office, I think I saw that as a path forward for me as well. I think as a single female practitioner in New York City, it was probably a different dynamic than my father's. But, you know, I had some personal relationships with people like Kate and Andy Spade, who were personal friends. And one of my first jobs was for them, the art world. I have friends in that world. So I did an art gallery. This was after the partnership broke up after 3 years. Yeah, so I built a practice and I had my practice for over 25 years.
Wow. Maybe that's a good point. So you walked us through what it was like as a little girl growing up in an environment where design, I loved how you put it. It wasn't a kind of an environment of pretentiousness, but just kind of a sense of appreciation. But curious, through the different generations today, I imagine the conversations your father was having, perspectives, principles versus principles of today have like vastly changed. In your own like experience as a practitioner, I had the opportunity to read one of your articles recently about just Gen Z, which I guess I'm in the millennial bucket, but from your father's days to Gen Z, I have to imagine that the conversations, what we value might be shifting. How do you even begin to think about that as a practitioner, but also as just some like as a student of architecture?
Yeah. I think your terminology, student of architecture, puts it perfectly. I think I always want to remain a student. I think some of the conversations are actually very similar. I think that the language might be different, but I think the values, a lot of the values are the same. I think one thing that my father taught me was a certain amount of humility in everything that you do. I mean, that's sort of tough to hold on to in New York, in a place like New York City, right? Where the humble can be crushed. But I think that there's a core value that you can hold on to that understands and acknowledges the significant impact that other people have.
Right.
And I do think, you know, the way my father practiced architecture is actually probably more in line with the way it should be and the where we are headed and where I feel like Arcadis already is pretty far ahead in that. This sort of sensitivity to like sight was huge for him always. And that's about place. That's about location. That's about how people interact with the place. And that's something that we look at really, and we take very seriously here. And that's something that my father took very seriously. And I think that it's something that Gen Z, right? It's particularly with the development of technology and how technology can divorce us from our place, right? I do think that over the course of the pandemic, where we were all isolated. And obviously we all took advantage of these digital tools, which provided us the opportunity to stay in touch, right? But, and now with more and more options to sort of divorce ourselves from reality, I do think that people are starving, you know, and that cuts across generations. And I actually think, I mean, I think it's important for us to acknowledge the needs of the younger generation and to respect their situation, right? Because they are in a far different place just in terms of sustainability. And I mean, where we sort of took it for granted, and certainly where my father was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that is probably one of the primary issues that we need to sit up and take notice and listen to their concerns and address them with them, right? We can't shut them out of the conversation. I think one of the things, and I know you sent a list of questions, but I actually did sort of prepare and stuff. And I like the fact that this is being a little bit more freewheeling.
Yeah.
Because I do think that in some ways, generations don't matter. You know, I mean, I really do think that we need to take that on. Because then you start setting up a hierarchy, right? I mean, I feel it myself. I'm like, I find myself saying certain things or reacting in certain ways. I'm like, okay, boomer. You know?
But to understand a hierarchy in what sense?
Well, you know, the classic is that like, well, we know more than you, right? Sure. I mean, granted, we have had more years on the planet, but I think that instead of taking that attitude of like sort of top down, it's more about sort of opening the door, right? Opening the door to sharing this knowledge. And also you have stuff to teach us, right? Because you're inhabiting worlds and applications and systems that a lot of us are not, we're either afraid to do it or we're too busy to do it. And I do think that somehow we have to find a way to, again, open the door instead of create this hierarchy of systems, because I don't think that's going to get us very far.
Yeah, I love that. I love how you framed this idea that I think, again, kind of using as benchmarks, like your father's generation, there's certain things perhaps we took very seriously and other things we took for granted. I remember when I went to college, sustainability almost felt as kind of like an add-on, almost as like, hey, quite literally as an elective, whereas perhaps the next generation might not have that flexibility simply because of the kind of perhaps debt we've acquired over the previous generations to like now they kind of have to deal with it. It's not an elective or certainly not an oversight. And yet with that, you mentioned something that's key, is that I have to imagine that while the things we use, the means and the tech that we use, whether we're talking about CAD or BIM or X or Y, you mentioned sight. I'm curious, are there any kind of principles that stand out to you that whether you're talking to your father's generation, the current generation, that just simply have not changed, that maybe stand out to you?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I mean, I certainly have my principles, which I think are pretty important, which they are sight, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are sort of two camps, right? I do think that there are people that in our profession, it's about efficiency, it's about rationality, you know, like the rational approach to solve the problem. I'm just here to solve a problem. And I'm going to do it in fastest, quickest, most cost-effective, efficient way. And yeah, you know, I can make it look okay, right? Just as long as it meets the bill, right? That's one camp. And then there's the other camp. There's the empathetic camp, which is where I sit and where Arcadis sits and where I think we all should be sitting, where it's about the people. And this is something that my father has always talked about, right? And that can be expressed through how light filters through something, how something sounds when you move across it, how something feels. Oftentimes, you work with people that have absolutely no sense of this whatsoever. I'm always sort of amazed at that. And a lot of them readily admit it, right? They're like, I have no creative bone in my body. I have no understanding. I just want it to be efficient. I just want it to be built under these specifications. And it's really about educating them. And I think that that's a role that we need to take on and not in an arrogant way. You know, I'll go back to my teaching, right? I mean, I remember the first time I started, first semester, I started teaching. And I was like second year undergraduate at City College, which is where my heart really is because they have the second most diverse student body in the country. And so I've had students, you name it, I've had them. It's just fantastic. First, lots of first generation students. And I remember throwing out these names that I knew when I was probably six. Alto, Van der Rohe, Gunnar Asplund, Saarinen, and they're all looking at me with this blank expression on their face. And I realized, oh my God, you had a really unusual upbringing. They don't know. They have no idea what you're talking about. And I realized it's my job. This is my job, is to teach them about these people, to teach them about these ideas, to expose them to these things. I still work that way, right? With my team. It's really about, to me, because I grew up in this very unusual environment where it was so lush with design, right? That I see it in everything. I'm not one of those people that I didn't grow up playing with Legos and thinking, oh, yes, I'm going to be an architect. Or I knew who Frank Lloyd Wright was, but to be honest, he wasn't a very popular name in the family household because there was a dynamic between Elsa and his Frank Lloyd Wright that was not very good, you know, because there was some arrogance there. And my great uncle was sort of a humble Scot, you know, immensely talented, but a different kind of person.
Yeah.
So to me, I'm always encouraging my team to, let me go back a little bit for the teaching, because one of the things that I learned in teaching, and this actually also came from my father, because my father always told me, you can tell he was a role model, right? I mean, so was my mother, because my mother, you know, she was like, everything was arranged in a beautiful way. You know, she chose a lot of these things. They were definitely a design partnership.
Mm-hmm.
But he said, you have to give people a sense of ownership. And I think that there's something, it's really about looking at a project or an idea that someone else may have and not dismissing it out of hand right off the bat, right? But trying to understand the thought process that went through of how they arrived there, maybe, and this is where the experience, the generational experience comes in. It's like, because I've seen so much more, I've had the opportunity to live in other countries and read books in other languages and just experience the world. Because I also am the kind of person that you probably figured out by now. I just, when an opportunity arises, I just grab it, right? But to help clarify their idea so that they can, or to somehow help carve out a path for them to pursue something that will help them clarify that idea, right? So there is always that sense of ownership that the idea rests with them. But you have helped to sculpt it, to craft it, to clarify it. And it's really the way that I think that's a value that was definitely taught by my father. And then I think the best architects in this world have that. The people that inspire people. I mean, it's one thing to do an amazing building and you get credit and all that stuff. It's another thing for me to impact other people, right? And my father always, like at the dinner table, like he used to take us around to job sites when the wood studs were up. He would walk us through these spaces and explain the experience. So, okay, you're entering through a private garden here. And so when you get to this threshold, you see that tree out there, like that's going to be on axis. And we had to fill in the blanks. We had to sort of build it in our minds. We really taught me how to see. And I think that that had an enormous impact on how I see the world, how I see the world of design, and how I see the interaction between me and other members of my team.
You mentioned something that I think has really stood out to me, and it's clear in your own upbringing experience. You've mentioned the importance of like exposure. And I think your life is kind of like a definition as to like from the time you were a little girl, being asked questions or being put into situations where you had to consider like, why does it matter to have that tree like aligned within the access? And like, these are things that going back to your example at City College, many folks maybe just did not have that kind of exposure. I mean, the folks that you were exposed to as a little girl, we would learn on like textbooks, you know, that I would say, like, right. What? You had friendships right. with these folks? I can't help but to like kind of reflect on my own experience. In my case, wasn't so much exposed to the kind of titans, if you will, of architecture, but, you know, just grew up with my parents working at a pizza shop. And in my case, next month, we'd be in business for about 6 years. And I've been retrospective about what in the world pushed me to start a company or startup. And I think it certainly wasn't school. I think it gave me the ingredients to appreciate the tool sets and how to ask questions and think about architecture. But in my case, it was actually just seeing my mom in the back of the house dealing with payroll and accounting and my dad in front of the house dealing with products and cheese and dough. And I took that for granted. And yet I kind of see a certain privilege that I have there as kind of an unfair advantage, just seeing that as a little kid.
Yeah.
As an adult now, have an appreciation for things that I think I didn't understand at the time, like my mom talking about how cheese has gone up a certain amount. And as a 12-year-old, I've got no idea why that actually matters to us.
Right.
But I think in that case, having seen that, I can't help but to think for me, it's been that kind of unfair advantage that now I can't help but to like want to share that with others. Had I not been exposed to the highs and lows of a business, I think in the early days, I think going through what I'm going through now, I couldn't help but to think like, is this normal or, you know? So right. Not a question, just an observation. I can't help but to think, like, I think what you mentioned is so critical. I guess as I think about students now, how we can bring design and specifically the exposure to this and tell a story as to like, hey, here's what we've dealt with before so that by the time they're learning about design, we're not having to start from a blank canvas.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that this is where technology is an asset, right?
Yeah.
Because someone who lives outside of an urban area, right, can somewhat get at least exposed initially to these ideas and these images. And images, they can't compete with actually experiencing the real thing, right? But it's a start. And obviously, all of those students of mine at City College, I mean, all of the people that are working here at Arcadis, right? Somehow, somewhere along the line, they were exposed to something that spoke to them about this world, right? And then they took the next step. And then here they are, right? Making a huge difference in the world. And it's something that I think, you know, a lot of people talk about this profession and how, you know, it's not a profession, it's an endeavor. It's like something that is part of your life. I mean, my father closed his office at 88. I mean, this was his life. And it is something, even in your own example, right? These pivots that you can take throughout the course of your life that started in architecture and design, all of what you learned in that architectural education informs everything that you do afterwards. And then you're just piling on the experiences, right? The travel, the people experiences, the challenges, the financial issues. You know, I mean, it's interesting. I think about, okay, I went from having a boutique firm and doing private residence, you know, commercial work and lots of retail and sort of a real variety of work. I never wanted to really specialize because, I mean, one, as a small firm, you can't, I don't think. You know, I think that's the beauty of having a boutique firm is that it teaches you how to take risks, right? Because you have to survive.
Yeah.
Basically go, oh, okay, we've never done that before. We can do it because we need the work, right? So we'll figure out a way. But I think that keeps you nimble and it keeps your creative brain elastic. And that's something that I bring here to this conversation. It's something that I think any advice for other designers and stuff, it's sort of like, take those risks, right? If it's something unfamiliar to you, just do it. You have your Nike camp on. And they're a client of ours, actually. True. It's like such a great tagline, right? Just do it because it's incredibly short and you may not get that opportunity again. And if you fail, you're going to learn something and you pick yourself up and you move on, you know, and do something else. I just think it's something that is sort of how I've lived my life. And I think that it's really important that designers remember to, you have to actually nurture a creative brain. It's like drawing. You have to draw to keep that skill up. People always say, well, you can always ride a bike. Maybe it's a little rusty in the beginning, but you never unlearn that skill, right? It's the same with drawing. But I think creativity, it's a muscle and you have to exercise it. And sometimes, you know how when you get, you know, muscle pains, when you've overworked or you've pulled a muscle or something like that, I think that it can happen in your life in terms of your creative process, but you learn from that and you actually get stronger from that.
I'm curious, with your team, these are some pretty important principles, right? That I think in your case, you started growing a boutique firm and now find yourself in a global practice. How do you somehow provide enough flexibility or freedom for their team to kind of find new solutions while at the same time kind of setting some kind of guardrail in? And how do you communicate that? You suggested maybe technology is one way, but how do you steer that ship?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I have to say about working in a firm of this scale is that a lot of people think, oh my God, you're the second largest firm in the world. You know, like, how do you manage that? Well, first of all, it's not the whole group, right? I mean, we're broken down into smaller teams. But the thing that's so beautiful about that is that anytime that we get a client coming to us with an issue, a challenge, program, be it sustainable practices, be it retail program or mixed use or an urban plan, we have such a big global footprint in terms of the talent and the people that we can zoom in on those people and draw from that talent, right? And from that, you create this incredible multidisciplinary team that, I mean, I would argue can't compete with pretty much anybody. And that's because of our global outreach, that kind of talent here. When it comes time to sort of the micro, right? I mean, obviously we do use technology, you know, like everybody else. I mean, we're doing this right now. Technology and the Miro board that allows us to create online. I mean, to me personally, I think nothing compares to face-to-face work, particularly with design work. We always try when we have a team that is slightly spread out, we always try to find and schedule those moments where we actually travel to those places and we have those moments where we're doing a workshop. I mean, it was really funny when I first started working here. Because I'm very tall, you know, and you can't tell that online. And I would meet these people that I've been having all these meetings with online and be like, oh my God, you're really tall. You're much taller than I thought you were. No, I had no idea. It's funny. I had a meeting yesterday about a project. Both of my team were remote and we were having a design meeting. And one of the things that I actually found was it worked better remotely. They were showing me drawings, images. The two different concepts, right?
Really?
And because I have more than one screen, I'm on the other screen, like grabbing references really quickly, right? And putting them in the chat. I'm like, look at this, you know, why don't you think about this? Why don't you think about that? And creating this situation where I'm just like a little bit bombarding them with stuff because it's their responsibility as designers, this is where I challenge them, right? To be able to filter through those and translate it in their way. Right.
Yeah.
And again, it goes back to that idea of giving them a sense of ownership, right? Which I think is so important. To me, it's like the way I think because of the way I was raised, this idea that design is in everything and architecture is in everything. Because to me, it's like, so I look at and I show my team, I'll bombard them with these images. And a lot of them sometimes are crop, It may be of an architectural space, but it may be cropped to just show something. It becomes sort of abstract, and it's more about the way two materials meet or the way light hits it or a tone. A lot of it is about tone, and it's emotional to me, right? So I look at landscape. I look at photography. I look at sculpture. I look at textiles. I look at fashion. I look at the natural environment. You know, you can look at microscopic views of plants, and they're amazing. They look like textiles. I mean, they're all structures. This is the thing to me. They are all structures. And so you can easily take that idea of how something is together or how something is formed, like Annie Albers textiles, how those are woven and the way that color is used. Like, okay, how could I reinterpret this concept or this tone into a facade or into a pattern or into how space is organized, right? I mean, it's endless. It's really endless. And that's what I see as my role. And that's what excites me, is sort of breaking that. You know, I don't necessarily really want people to show me images of other people's work. You know, you got to understand what's out there. You have to remain on top of what's out in the market, what your competitors are doing, all of that. But to me, it's about developing that unique voice. And the only way to develop and cultivate that unique voice is for them to actually like build that muscle, right? So yeah. I'm there to help them build that muscle. And it doesn't really matter like where they are, right?
Yeah. I think sharing your experience is so critical, because I can't help but to recall the story that you said as a little girl being taken to the site, like a construction site. And I contrast that to even conversations that perhaps you and I have with our teams, whether remotely on screens. What I can't help but to think about is that if by default we're designing buildings on screens, I've noticed that we over-optimize for two of our five senses that I think are lost. So we over-optimize obviously for how something looks and then typically how we hear, but the way it smells, feels, like the textiles that you mentioned, that's kind of hard to relay that without experiencing it. And I don't know how we reconcile that. I'm curious what implications, say, this kind of certain wave, right? I think of my graduate school experience as kind of a start of this like digital rendering phase where we like over-optimized for like how it looked on the poster, but really had no senses to like anything. In fact, we often didn't even consider anything else.
Right. Yeah. I actually think it's sort of somewhat an issue with the way we educate architects here, right? In that it steers people in that direction, whereas in other parts of the world, oftentimes they do consider all these other elements.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure that there's a simple answer to that, other than I do think that, I'm just going to go back to this, because again, it's one of our core values here at Arcadis. It's like, it's about the human. It's about the people. Like we can, with the advent of AI, for example, you know, of course we're using AI, you know, and we're excited about it and we're exploring it. But the thing is, it's, and our clients, right? Particularly like retail clients, you know, they're understanding that they can use it as a tool to optimize and streamline a lot of research, right? Like they can analyze foot traffic and the impact that foot traffic has on conversion, or what people want, what your customers want, how to deliver that more effectively in terms of like smart building, right? It's like creating these systems and to ultimately create a healthier place for people. And that is the bottom line to me. It's like, we cannot lose sight of the people and the human and empathy, creating empathetic spaces and experiences and environments that some people will get it immediately. People like us. Right? People that are highly sensitized to the environment. I mean, you can't take me anywhere. You know, it drives my husband nuts. He's the same way with ideas, right? Like philosophical ideas. I mean, when we travel, I'm just always like, why would you put that there? I'm like, why would they do this? And he's like, can we just enjoy it? It's like, oh, no, I can't. Because someone made the decision. You know, I mean, I was in a hotel and I wasn't the only one. And it was a brand new hotel and it was super swanky. Nobody could find the light switches. I mean, how basic is that? Like literally, I had to leave the light on in the shower, in the bathroom all night because I could not for the life of me turn this thing off. Like that's basic, basic stuff, right? Where you just think, oh, the technology is going to solve it. It's like, no, you forgot about the human. You forgot about instinct and intuition. So for people that are not highly sensitized to it, like you and I, you have to remember those people, right? So a lot of times it's not about hitting people over the head with like, oh, isn't this an amazing experience in space? It's very, it's sort of under the radar, right? So that subconsciously, after like 10 minutes or something, and they're sitting in a mixed use, a garden that's out, you know, they're having lunch outside in the courtyard in a shopping center that is designed more for the human interaction and the site and the landscape. And they're like, oh, you know, this is really nice. They may not be able to put their finger on it, but they'll be back, which is also part of our job, right? Mm-hmm. Retail and mixed use. It's like, I often talk about it. It's about telling story, but a story, there's a structure to stories, right? There's a beginning, there's a middle, there's an end. And there's usually some high point in the story. There's a climax. Experience with retail and mixed use, it's very similar. But the thing is, you don't want to let them down, right? You don't want to, like, after that high point, it's like, oh no, it's all downhill from here. And then you're like, okay, I'm done with the book. Like, that's what the story is. It's like, no. You want to entice them. You want to make them want to explore the story deeper and come back. And also, maybe that means there's, like, if you think about it in architectural terms, it's like, maybe it's about making the place like super flexible so that maybe when they come back, it doesn't look quite the same. It's giving our clients the ability to do that in an economic and efficient way to create this magic, but it's not a one-off. You know what I mean? It's a little bit like when you read a story, or it's like binge watching in a way.
Yeah.
It's like, you just want to keep going, right? You want to keep going. And in a way, like, that's how we need to think about these experiences, because this experience is used profusely in our world, right? Particularly in retail and these mixed use environments, right? The experience. It's like, well, people are pretty aware that that's what we're doing. And so how do you make that experience vibrant and living? Instead of this sort of the Instagram moment, the one-off, you know, that kind of thing. And how does it change? Again, that's going back to that flexible, nimble, creative mind and exercising that muscle, right? It's the same. It's exercising that muscle of telling the story in an organic and flexible way so that you're constantly like, oh, there's more, come. You got, no, come back, right? I mean, that's what makes this work to me so much fun. You know, is how do you create these stories that are living, right? That are not just beginning, middle, end, but it becomes this loop that sometimes it gets bigger, sometimes it gets really small and intimate, and it's like, it's organic. Well, it's fantastic. I mean, who gets to do this kind of work? Like, how lucky are we?
Robin, this has been absolutely refreshing. You know, often I get the opportunity to sit down with some really smart folks, you know, often having conversations as to what's changing. And yet I think perhaps the most important one is what's likely not changing. And I think this, in my view, is kind of a discussion 101 that I think everyone needs to hear. It's all of the evolution of AI and tech and design tech and BIM and CAD. Oftentimes I find more refreshing to talk about what's likely not going to change. And so I think your perspective has been incredibly refreshing as a sobering reminder that, you know, there's kind of very much human amidst all of the kind of different means and tools that are evolving. So I can't wait to have you on for a part 2.
Great. Yeah, no, it's been super, super fun. And it's always nice to have these conversations with people that, I mean, particularly younger people, right? Yeah. I mean, that leaves me incredibly optimistic. My husband would say I'm definitely not an optimist, but I would like to say that I am an optimist. You know, because he's a philosopher, he parses these things. He's very specific about these things. But I do think that, to me, it's like, and I go back to the way I was raised, it's about this sort of deep appreciation of life itself, right? I recently, basically, I've lost all of my family except for my brother and I. And throughout this process, my brother and I will have these conversations like, can you believe the way we were raised? Oh my God. Like, how magical was that childhood? You know, and it wasn't this like, I mean, we were always told you can be whatever you want to be. It's funny. My father never encouraged us to do what he did. Never, never, never. And all of us ended up, you know, my sister, who's no longer alive, she was an interior designer. It's like all of us fell into that world because it's something that gave us a connection to our roots and our family and all of the love and experiences that we had growing up. And I feel incredibly, incredibly lucky. And so now it's my job, right, to like spread that. I mean, it's so great. What better job?
I can't help but to smile. I think that the passion, I think the exposure you've seen, and you've got quite a bit of responsibility on your shoulders to, like you said, kind of share those experiences. I can't wait. And I'm just super excited to continue seeing, you know, your career evolve. And there's a lot of folks out there that need to hear your story.
Thanks so much.
I've had a blast. If folks want to follow your work or your team's work, how do they find you?
Well, I'm on LinkedIn. I have a personal Instagram, which is a different kind of thing, right? Where you can, people can follow all of my sort of wild and crazy, my observations. You know, I make observations about the experiences that I have around me, the cultural experiences, because I travel a lot. Mm-hmm. I'm always looking at things in my unusual way. We also have a website. We also have LinkedIn. We are extremely active just in the public realm in general. But I'd probably say Instagram and LinkedIn.
Can't wait to have you for a part two. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Robin.